in international relations courses, basic ones, the first thing you learn is that historically, countries have always been their neighbors' enemies. This is pretty obvious to most of us. For example, Germany and Poland were natural enemies because they bordered on each other. France and Germany were natural enemies because they bordered on each other. And the earliest at the time, the earliest when I was taking these courses, the earliest treaty was on cuneiform tablets, and it was a treaty where two countries were making common cause against the country between them. In other words, each of them bordered on the country between them, and that was their natural enemy. And this was sort of accepted as a basic rule of international relations. It's a basic rule of all questions of alliance, and it relates to what David Duke is doing right now. For example, when David went to Syria, it certainly wasn't because there's any great overlap between the culture of Louisiana and the culture of the Middle East, but we have a common set of enemies. And therefore, what you have to do is not look among your neighbors for your allies. You have to look beyond their borders, directly beyond their borders. When I say a common set of enemies, I'm not talking just about a Jewish conspiracy or something hidden or something like that. I remember in Arkansas, back around, I forget, it was one of the crises that maybe 72, when Israel was having a real crisis, and one of the Republicans, one of the campaign officers said, "Well, we have a good chance this time because all of the Jewish money that would go to liberal causes will be going to helping out Israel." Well, of course, there was one loud shriek of "A Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews," anti-Semitism, all the usual chorus. But as it happened, the Democratic funds, liberal Democratic funds, party in Arkansas is very liberal, did in fact dry up because the money had to go to Israel. I've noticed that big conservatives were putting on programs where Christians would give money so that Jews in Russia could go to Israel. Now, that takes pressure off of American liberals, American Jews who supply, on the record, 50% of the contributions for the Democratic Party. So, what they're doing, of course, I don't know, I guess it's a good way. They get a piece of the money they raise, these Christian conservatives, and believe me, there are great big quotation marks around Christian when I'm talking about this kind of people. But what they do is they're using the money of Christians to take pressure off of Democrat off of Jewish interests, and the same Jewish interests are going to then be able to spend money on liberal causes, which the conservatives say they don't support. So this is just practical politics. And anytime you get logical, somebody's going to start screaming, "Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews." But the simple fact of the matter is that the same money that supports Israel is the money that supports the leftists here. Which is kind of funny because, of course, they're run by the Likud, which is a right-wing party. But it's a Jewish right-wing party. But the Jews have a realistic view of these things. I explained the general Jewish attitude to somebody in plain sense terms, not in international Jewish conspiracy terms. I said, in international relations and in politics in general, your competitor slash enemy, depending depending on what the situation is always the person on your border. Who is on the Jewish border in this world? Well, everybody. And the general attitude of the Jewish community is hostile. It ranges from disagreement. It's all like Germany and France. It ranges from sort of an uneasy peace to outright war, but it's not a friendly attitude. So you have to contrast this, though, to the fact that in politics, you have to make coalitions with people around you. That's what politics is all about, normal politics. That's why I keep making the distinction between the kind of politics, revolutionary politics, that I'm interested in, and regular politics. In regular politics, competitive groups keep making peace with each other, or trying to, but you can't really expect for white Gentile Americans, Jews, American Jews, and American Hispanics, American Blacks, American Indians, to be actual allies with each other in politics. You have to look beyond the people that they are in competition with. You have to find out who they are in competition with. Now, the Jews did that. They do that regularly. In fact, in international relations, you normally, what you do when you're dealing with an enemy is that is to say, well, not necessarily an enemy. Let's say like Britain and France were at war with each other for several centuries, from the Hundred Years' War up to when Napoleon lost at Waterloo. In fact, they almost had a war around 1860 or 1870. They were in a constant state of either competition or outright warfare. And, of course, Germany has invaded Poland over and over and over, and Russia, any countries that are on each other's borders, are going to be competitors / enemies. In regular everyday politics, we tend to think in tactical terms, that is to say, how are we going to win the next election? And that usually means compromising our interests with the interests of other groups who are in competition with us. So there's always the attempt of the Republicans to pick up the minority vote, and it never works for a very simple, basic reason. The Republican Party is, as the Democrats say, becoming more and more the white party. Now, the inevitable result of this is that the Democrats are becoming the party of minorities. Both of them deny this vehemently, and when politicians really start denying something vehemently, you know it's true. The Republican Party is becoming pretty solidly white as far as its support is concerned, and they keep trying desperately to get the black vote. But what is happening is that the liberals represent minority interests in the United States. Republicans are against the liberals, and they're the only opposition we have. They certainly don't represent our interests. But what is happening is what anybody who's ever been in international relations or any other kind of competition would realize would be inevitable. That is to say, the real competition growing in this country is between the majority, what Wilmot Robson called the majority, what we think of as the majority, whites, and the minorities. And no matter how hard you try to avoid it and sweep it under the table, politics is going to follow that rule. And American politics are a good example of, regardless of what everybody keeps saying they're not or what they say they are, inevitably, the two groups that are side by side, minority groups and whites, are competitors. So the Democrats become more and more a minority, a party of minorities. Republicans become more and more a white bread party, as they are shameful, as they keep denying. And if you look at the arithmetic, it's a little amazing, because when I was coming up, if the parties were, the Republicans were always the minority in both houses of Congress, and they won the presidency a lot with moderate candidates. But the fact was that if in 1980 you had said that there was going to be as big a set of minorities as there are today, you would have said, well, then the Democrats will have control of both. I mean, they will go from mere control of both parties to a completely disappeared Republican Party, because the minorities vote solidly for the Democrats. But the more minorities we have, the stronger the Republicans get. Now, this won't go on forever, but I think it's of some importance to note that the Republican Party went from a minority in 1965, when the immigration law was changed, to let in all these minorities, and when the Civil Rights Bill were passed, back then the Democrats were a solid majority with very tiny, relatively small minority support. There weren't that many. There were maybe 10 to 20% of the vote. Now that it's becoming a third of the vote or more, the Republicans are the actual majority. Now something has really happened here. Not just that the Republicans have gained, they shouldn't exist according to the kind of politics I was raised on. When I was coming up, the Democratic Party had heavy white support in the South. It had heavy white support among Northern Irish, Northern Italians, Polish, all these so-called ethnic groups. And they're the base of the Democratic Party until the 60s was the Northern Machine Democrats, who were based on the Irish, and the Southern Whites. Those were the basis of the Democratic Party. Now those are the two groups that have turned completely against the Democratic Party. And one of the greatest factors in American politics has been ignored, that the whole white base of the Democratic Party has moved over. And today, we call the Northern Irish and the Southern Whites Reagan Democrats. They used to be called Wallace Democrats. So that the solid support from whites, the whites have simply moved out of the Democratic Party. And that is why, despite the fact that the minority vote has grown explosively, the Republicans gained power. In other words, now let's boil everything I've said down to plain English. What's going on in the real world has nothing to do with what commentators are talking about. Republican commentators are talking about getting a minority vote. Well, what that means is that they aren't getting a minority vote. The Democrats are now talking about an offensive to get back the traditional values people, i.e., the white vote. Now, what all that commentary tells you is not what's actually going on. If you do this stuff for a living, as I did, it tells you the whatever the commentators are talking about, you have to take it and find the truth. And the truth is, the Republicans are becoming a white party, the Democrats are becoming a minority party. So regular politics, the natural breakdown of the electorate, is going to happen no matter what. So the political commentary, all it does for you is tell you, if you are a little cynical, And if you're going to make your living in this game, you'd better be cynical. It just tells you what the reality is. The reality is what the commentators are denying. Now let's get back to what David Duke is doing. David is out there in Eastern Europe, in the Ukraine, in Syria, finding allies for us against our enemies. At this moment, our enemies, generally speaking, are our Eastern establishment, which includes Hollywood. Basically, the liberals look at the United States as Hollywood, New York, New England, and a bunch of flyover country between the two, as they call it, flyover country. And the ruling Europeans today are allied with the New Englanders. And things get pretty complicated because we have enemies inside our own borders, so to speak. We have, for example, these so-called Christian conservatives who are fanatically in favor of Israel, and they're pushing interracial adoption and that sort of thing. But in general, I think what I'm talking about should be pretty familiar to you. The Europeans want to suppress all dissent. They want to say that any real dissent, legitimate dissent, comes from the left. And they put our people who dissent, who actually argue with their policies, in jail. And of course, the liberals want to pass hate laws too. So I have to sort of depend on your understanding when I'm talking about generally. We could spend all day arguing about, well, the East has a lot of friends of ours. Well, I'm an honorary Boston Southie. I know very well that we have allies over there. But I'm trying to present a general picture of the, you might say, more or less loyal white Gentiles and those who hate, and the white Gentiles who hate white Gentiles. And, of course, the Europeans, European leadership, openly, fanatically hates whites. On the other hand, these are the people we are competing with. Now we're talking about strategy here. In terms of strategy, international, and by national I mean whatever group you represent, I look at, for example, the South and the Midwest, the basic American white Gentile population, as having allies under the aegis of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So Eastern Europe, for example, is on something of a collision course with Western Europe. I personally don't believe that Eastern and Western Europe can really come together, but that is the way we have to look at it. We have to not look at politics in tactical terms, that is, say, the next election or whatever, because in tactical terms, politics are pretty well settled in America. And when there get to be enough minorities, the Republican Party will disappear. But what the Democrats have not taken into account is that the Democratic Party will also disappear. Now, if you're into tactical politics, if your obsession is whether the federal budget is balanced or not, or whether a Republican wins a particular seat, none of this has any meaning to you. And that's the way I made my living, of course. But my real interest is strategic politics, and that is where all of our present thinking collapses. Now, I said that the Democrats will disappear when the minorities get big enough. And the reason for that is that at this moment, as I've said before, we're in the Tonto stage, where the minorities are essentially the faithful colored companions to liberals. They do whatever liberals tell them to. And as long as they think of themselves as a minority, as long as their power remains down in terms of the Republicans, the opposition, it's not a very effective opposition, but that's where all the effort goes, they are going to be faithful colored companions. But the time will come when they're going to get very tired of running everything past Teddy Kennedy. And at this moment, the present situation is that the minorities are firmly united against the white Gentiles, i.e. the Republicans. And this is not going to change because we are bordering on each other, whites and non-whites. More and more whites are bordering on more and more non-whites. And so the competition between the groups is going to lead to a split between two parties. But when whites become a minority, then these groups are going to start demanding their own voices. We're going to start dealing between whites and Oriental groups and colored groups and Hispanic groups. We're going to stop dealing through Teddy Kennedy. We're going to start dealing with each other. Well, I don't know exactly how that's going to look. That's my problem is I have had to deal in too many real world politics. So what I'm handing you is not a formula. I'm handing you an idea of how things are just going to look. And at this moment, the big deal is the Democrats versus Republicans. But the Democrats versus Republicans isn't going to have any meaning in another 50 years. When the United States has enough minorities in it, we're going to break down a whole different formation. We had that with the collapse of the Whig Party. The Whig Party was the opposition party for one to two generations before the Civil War. And one day, they disappeared. In fact, their last president was Millard Fillmore. He was president until 1853. And then the Republican Party was formed. And it completely replaced the Whigs. They just disappeared. A major party just disappeared off the face of the earth. And that's going to happen again. But both of these parties that presently exist simply don't fit into the strategy of looking at the future. Now, for most politicians, this could make less difference. They are interested in the next election and what happens down the road. You know, you've heard the statement many, many times that 2 years is an eternity in politics. And in political tactics, that's very true. That every 4 years is just another age of man in politics, because you don't get elected to office if you are worried about the long run. You have to play tactics to get elected to office. What I'm interested in is political strategy. I'm interested in what will be when I'm dead, much less when I'm running. The average politician is worried about what's going to be going on when he runs for election next time. I'm worried about what's going to be going on when I'm dead. And the kind of thing that's going to matter in the long run is the kind of thinking I'm trying to introduce you to here. When the Republican and Democratic parties go the way of the Whigs, and we have a whole new set of opposition groups, whites may find themselves allying with other groups, with minority groups, but we're also going to find that a lot of these alliances, for example, when we're fighting for free speech, Ukraine, the biggest university in the Ukraine, the one that gave David Duke his doctor's degree, they are going to be engaged in this struggle. They are right now, in a way, they are actually standing up to the people who want to suppress all dissent on questions like the Holocaust. And So this is a rather strange alliance. We're going to find that while at this moment very few Arabs could really care less about whether some professor gets jailed in France, this is one of the major battlefields, is the battle for free speech. And we're going to find our allies on the other side of, in other words, they're going to be the people that are on the other side geographically of our enemies, the ones we're in competition with. So I've gone a long way trying to explain something very simple, that strategic alliance is going to be entirely different from tactical alliance. Once again, revolutionary politics, strategic politics, are the exact opposite of tactical politics, coalition politics. That is what the Boaz group of Jews practiced. They said what Franz Boaz pushed as a Jew. He was a Prussian Jew, and he had been kicked around a lot in Prussia, and he came to America with a real hatred of white Gentiles. And his dream was to get all the colored peoples in the world to unite behind Jewish leadership against white Gentiles. And to a great extent, after World War II, that was accomplished. It's still the way we think today, so Franz Boas. But you see, Boas wasn't running for office. Boas was playing the game of political strategy. He was a professor. And he is probably today, if you say who had most influence, nobody ever mentions Boas. People talk about Reagan or Franklin Roosevelt or all these people. But if you talk about who determined the future of America, it wouldn't be a president, it wouldn't be a congressman. All they did was sort of go along with political tactics from election to election. Franz Boas had more to do with determining the future of America than anybody you hear about. He was playing strategy, and he had this dream of a colored world behind a Jewish leadership. Well, what happened to that dream of Boaz? Boaz died in 1944, just before the end of World War II, when his ideas really took over. And Jewish liberals went ahead with the business of a coalition between an anti-white coalition. And what happened to them was what is going to happen to the Democrats. You see, in the early days of this, when Boas was doing all this, the whole idea of the black vote was rather absurd because it was so tiny. And as for the Third World, which he was looking forward to having Jews lead, liberal Jews, it was all colonial. So his whole pipe dream, as people thought of it, was insane at the time. Then, suddenly, the colonial countries got their independence. All of a sudden, the UN was dominated by colored countries. All of a sudden, American politics became more and more dominated by minorities. But the Jews now are in a position where the people that they sought to lead are now their worst enemies. The only friends that Israel has in the whole world are white Gentiles. If it were up to the minorities, colored countries in the UN, Israel would cease to exist tomorrow. Or it may take a little longer than that, but you know that it takes the UN, it takes the veto of France or the United States to stop the UN from doing what it wants to do about Israel. It's on the side of the Palestinians. In Europe, the Arabic vote is growing fast. Now remember, this was one of the great victories of the whole anti-white Gentile strategy of Franz Boas, was to open the borders, to integrate, to open the borders, to bring in the third world. All that would be part of his dream strategy. Well, the net result at this point is that Europe is building a huge electorate which has an attitude toward Jews which is slightly more hostile than Adolf Hitler's. And I think that we have to look for the liberals who think in terms of their faithful colored companions when their faithful colored companions don't have a lot of support or don't have a majority yet or driving the whites together. Right now, it looks as if the dream world for liberals would be a world where they would take over the leadership of the minorities, which would dominate America. The problem is, as the old saying used to go in the South, it'd say, black people would get uppity. Well, in the 1960s, when they started feeling their power, the black people started getting uppity. The NAACP never, from its founding in 1905 to 1965, had never had a black president. The president was always Jewish. It was the Boas strategy. But then the blacks got uppity, and they took over the NAACP. And, of course, we have Louis Farrakhan and a bunch of other people who really don't like Jews. But this, again, is what is going to happen, probably, to the liberals. So, in terms of strategy, you just have to think differently. You have to see the future is not going to be the way people think it will be. Everybody today thinks that the liberals are going to take over, or the Republicans are going to become a white party or something. What's going to happen is exactly what happened before the Civil War. Neither party, the Democratic Party, could not stay together because it couldn't agree on slavery. The Republican Party was against the expansion of slavery. The Republicans took over and we had a war. I'm not sure what's going to happen. But whatever it is, it's not going to look the way that people think it is. We have to think in strategic terms, and too many people talk in tactical terms about politics. Well, I hope that I sure covered a lot of ground. I hope that what I said hangs together for you. And if it doesn't, I'll keep on trying to explain it. But what I'm telling you is I'm not giving you a formula for anything. I'm telling you that the formulas people give you have absolutely nothing to do with real long-term strategic politics. We're going to have to build it right back from the ground up. This is Bob Whitaker, the Untrained Eye, and I look forward to talking to you again.